Philip Baker Hall is best known for his performances in the films of Paul Thomas Anderson. Hall played a gambler in Hard Eight, a porn mogul in Boogie Nights, and a Whiz Kids game show host in Magnolia. Hall is great at playing hard-boiled, even in his role as a library cop tracking down overdue books in a now-classic episode of Seinfeld. His other films include Bruce Almighty, The Talented Mr. Ripley, and Air Force One. Now Philip Baker Hall is co-starring in Die, Mommy, Die, a satire of melodramas from the 1950s and 60s. Charles Bush, who wrote the screenplay, stars in drag as an over-the-hill pop star once known as America's Nightingale. She lives in a mansion with her husband, a producer, played by Philip Baker Hall, and their two children. He suspects she's been cheating on him, so he's hired a private detective. In this scene, he's presented to his wife photos taken by the private eye showing explicit evidence of adultery. Here's Hall and Bush.
I'd say these are certainly grounds for divorce.
Never! I am sentencing you to life imprisonment, baby, and I am going to be the warden.
You're mad.
We are a famous couple, Angela, and we're going to stay that way in public, if not in private.
And this will bring you happiness.
Nobody makes a dirty joke out of Saul P. Sussman. You are my possession. I own you just like I own every toilet in this house.
Saul, are you all right?
Don't get your hopes up. It's not a heart attack. It's this damn constipation.
Philip Baker Hall, welcome to Fresh Air. What movie types did you think of in creating this character? Because Die, Mommy, Die is in part a kind of loving satire of a lot of films.
Here's what I was going for. I thought it would be interesting to try to create a character, and I guess Hollywood is full of these types, maybe the world is full of these types, an actual person for whom there is virtually no limitation. He can abuse anybody, he can love anybody, he can help anybody, he can hurt anybody, he can be a bull in a china shop anytime he wants to, as much as he wants to. He can do and say absolutely anything he wants. So that was kind of a concept that I started with for this guy.
And as
a person with no social or civic or human responsibility whatsoever.
Is this the first time your leading lady has been a man in drag?
Well, as far as I know. We don't know everything, you know, in some of these movies.
Did that affect your performance at all?
No, it didn't. Not in the least. Charles, of course, I mean, as he's been doing for years in his various female personae, Charles does it with such amazing skill and such charm that, you know, it, for all practical purposes, he might as well have been a beautiful young woman. I mean, Charles is pretty amazing.
Now, the first time I really noticed you, and I think I'm speaking for a lot of people here, was in the movie Hard Eight, which was written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, and you were also in his films Boogie Nights and Magnolia. In Hard Eight, you play a gambler who knows all the angles at the casinos, and you become a father figure to a real loser, someone who's a loser in life and at the casinos, played by John C. Reilly. Philip Baker Hall, do you want to describe your character a little bit more in that movie?
Yeah, Sidney is the character's name, and he's a guy who travels alone, lives alone, and he's worked out a kind of a scheme for his life, which is to make the circuit of all the big casinos and work the system. He's an expert at working the system and getting the free lodging and the free meals and. And he's not like a big time game player at the casinos. He's a clever game player, and I think he maintains a kind of anonymity. And he's whenever he comes into a casino, we kind of get the feeling in the movie that this is part of his route, that he's been here before. All the people seem to know him and they like him. He's a good tipper and he minds his own business.
What's the story behind how you met Paul Thomas Anderson and made this movie with him? It was his first film.
Yeah, I was doing a movie for public television in L.A., and Paul was a volunteer production assistant. And he was basically getting the coffee and helping out with the little chores on the set. And we would have coffee and cigarettes between takes, and we became friendly. And and what brought us together initially was the fact that Paul, of course, I didn't know where Paul Thomas Anderson was going at this point. He was just a very young man who had an almost encyclopedic film knowledge. And he was one of the few people I had met who had seen every movie that I had ever made. And he seemed to have a line on my whole film career. It was flattering, and it was unusual. So at one point I asked him what his ambition was, and he said it was to be a writer and maybe to be a director. And by the way, he said, I have a short script, and there's a great role for you in it, and I would love to give it to you and get your opinion of it. And if you like it, maybe we could do it. So he sent me this 28-minute script, short feature is what it was, called Cigarettes and Coffee. And the writing was so extraordinary that I almost lost my balance and fell down. I'm serious. It was absolutely amazing. I could not believe the quality of the writing, the maturity of the characters and of the ideas in the script and the subtext. It was amazing. I was flabbergasted. And we did that short film. And it got Paul on the map as a young director. It showed at a lot of festivals around the world. And then Sundance eventually screened it and asked him to come up one summer with a feature that he would like to put into their workshop. And that's when he wrote Heart 8, which was originally called Sydney. So that's where we met.
I want to ask you about another Paul Thomas Anderson film that you were in, and this is Magnolia, in which you played a television, a host of a quiz show for kids, for really precocious kids.
Yes.
And you also have a very dark side in your personal life, which I won't go into.
Right.
In case anybody wants to watch it and be very surprised.
Right.
So let's just hear a scene here, and this is a scene in which you're hosting the show.
End of round one. Excellent work, ladies and germs. I think we should take a look at the scores on the board here. Kids are up a leg with 1,500, and the adults are down a little bit with 1,025. So we'll be back for round two, and a ring-dang-do. Oh, hello, hello. Bonus musical question, and the winner is... Kids! Kids are in the lead. They get a chance here to pull further and farther ahead if they can answer the following secret bonus musical question. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a line to you from an opera. I want you to give me that line back in the language in which the opera was originally written. And for a bonus 250, you can sing it. Here's the line. Love is a rebellious bird that nobody can tame. And it's all in vain to call it if it chooses to refuse. Yes, Stanley.
Well, that was in French. And that was from the opera Carmen. And that goes... L'amour est un vaisseau rebelle que nous...
That's my guest, Philip Baker Hall, in a scene from the movie Magnolia. What did you draw on for this character?
Well, Paul and I, we spent a fair amount of time together before that, talking about this character. And Paul had done some research, and he had some personal experience also with someone who was having a kind of an Alzheimer's problem, as well as perhaps a series of mini strokes, which is what we were kind of exploring there.
Right, and if our listeners didn't catch this, your memory's going a little bit. You're having a little bit of trouble in the scene that we just heard.
Yeah. And there's, I guess, quite a bit of literature about this phenomenon where you can have these little strokes and sort of not be aware that you're having a stroke, but they accumulate. The effect of them accumulates until finally you're almost unable to speak, which is where my character sort of gets at one point in this film. So that was my preparation for that aspect of the role. The other preparation that Paul and I did together was, I don't know if this channel is still operating on television or not, but at the time there was a channel that played nothing but old quiz shows and old game shows from the earliest days of television. So I remember we sat one day virtually all day and just watched this channel and watched all these old quiz show guys from 25, 30 years ago just to get a line on what just the modus operandi of guys who do this for a living, who do nothing but relate either to kids or to contestants, and how that colors and changes their personality as people.
What did you pick up on from that?
Oh, just the kind of offhand and shallow kind of personal relationships that, hey, I'm not indicting anybody who does that for a living, believe me. All these are honorable professions, and I do respect them. But if somebody does this kind of job for 20 years, I think you're not looking to go very far below the surface here. A manner, a way of dealing with people, of relating to people, and that ultimately, however, culminates maybe in some very difficult personal relationships at home with one's own children or one's own wife or one's own family. This was an aspect of, because as we looked at many of these people, we noted in cases that we knew about that there were a lot of well-publicized family problems, especially with the children of famous people who do nothing but this kind of work. So it was an education for us, and it helped Paul to solidify certain things in the script, and it helped me to get a handle on what to go for in the preparation of the role.
Anyone who's seen Magnolia knows that at the end of the movie there's literally a rain of frogs in which frogs just kind of fall from the sky. When I interviewed Paul Thomas Anderson after Magnolia came out, he said that when he was first talking to you about the script, he told you that he was writing in a rain of frogs. And what you told him was that you had actually been in a rain of frogs and that these things actually happen. And I was never sure if Paul Thomas Anderson was pulling my leg or not.
No, it's really true.
What happened?
When I was in the Army, and I was stationed in Germany, and I was driving on a vacation, actually, from Germany to Italy, and I was going over the Brenner Pass in the Alps at night, and it was a huge rainstorm and fog. It was a very bad time to be crossing the Brenner Pass, but I started when it was light and got caught in a storm there. And I noticed these things hitting the windshield and hitting the car at a certain point. And the fog became, I remember the fog became so dense that I had to open the door of the next to the steering wheel and look down at the yellow or white line on the road in order to keep from driving off the road. I could not see ahead of me at all, not at 1 foot. And I'm seeing these splots. All these things are hitting the car. They were frogs. And I remember when I successfully came off, I mentioned to the guards, I think, as I came into Italy, something about that, and they said, it happens. We've seen that before. Not a big deal. So it happens. Yeah, it's real.
So what exactly happened? How did the frogs end up on your windshield? Where were they coming from?
They were coming out of the sky with the rain. Now, hey, what the
you're going to have to do better than that for me.
Yeah, I know it's not good. And I never understood the physics of it. But somehow these mini cyclones pick things up out of ponds and everything, and they're just carried in the clouds, and then they're released.
Oh, I see.
It has been explained to me in that way, that these little gusts, cyclonic gusts, pick up things. Because frogs are not the only things that have rained down. Snakes have rained down. Fish have rained down. Anything that a pond can carry. There are plenty of instances, so I understand, of these things being returned to the earth then as in a rainstorm.
Huh. So you had no problem with this in the script, apparently.
None whatsoever, no. Okay. I know a lot of people who saw the movie said, boy, what was that all about? Where did that come from? And, of course, it's also biblical, too, so all that stuff is in there.
Right. What was it like to kind of really break into film when you were already probably in your 60s, right?
Late 50s and early 60s. It was, it meant a lot of things. First of all, I have two small children. I have a 7-year-old daughter and a 2.5-year-old daughter. And now a 2.5-year-old daughter. It helped me to be able to secure their future, which was something that had been concerning me before that. There, the only one had been born then. It also personally, of course, meant for me certain significant changes in my life. For example, I don't have to go in and audition anymore, which is great. Okay, once you get on the map in a certain way as a performer, you are relieved of the terrible responsibility of going in and having to prove that you can do the part, which I'd been doing all my life for the most part. And so it's nice not to have to do that. I really, really appreciate that. And it also, just at the ego level, it's very nice to get this the recognition. And the recognition, I never yearned to be recognized at the supermarket or to have to wear dark glasses or to protect myself or anything. That was never part of what I was aiming for. But I always did want peer recognition. No doubt about that. It is great to be recognized by other wonderful artists. That is gratifying.
I want to ask you about your voice. Your voice is often, you're often in these kind of tough or authoritative type of roles, whether it's somebody, with a lot of power in a cabinet position, or whether it's, somebody who's connected to gangsters. I know your voice is capable of being really tough. I can't quite place it geographically. It always sounds very urban to me, but I can't really say I hear or I can locate a particular accent. Where are you from?
I'm from Ohio. I was born in Toledo, Ohio, and I grew up there. My father was from Montgomery, Alabama, so I certainly don't speak, unless a character requires it, with any kind of a southern dialect, but there may be something may have been added or taken out of the Midwestern aspect of it by hearing my father, who did pretty much maintain his accent and dialect. So, and then I was in New York for 16 years also. So, and also as an actor, one who studied dialects and vocal tricks of one kind or another, as required for an actor, especially a character actor, maybe it's been flattened out in some way that you can't determine where it came from. But I am from the Midwest. In fact, somebody asked me once, they wanted me to do something. I don't know if it was for a commercial or what. They wanted me to do a Midwestern accent, and I thought I was already doing it.
So. Right. There you go. What did your father do when you were growing up?
My father worked in Toledo at the Willis Overland plant, which was an automobile plant, and during the Second World War, they produced the Jeeps. Most of the Jeeps that were used in the Second World War were made in Toledo, and then later it was Kaiser Frazier Automotive, and they made the Nash Rambler and all these cars, and that's what he did. He worked at a factory most of his life.
How had your family been affected by the Depression?
My father had, and his brother, in the 20s, had a very successful tire vulcanizing shop. In the 20s, when automobiles were really becoming popular and everybody was having a car, the whole business of tires and how to maintain them and keep them going without buying new ones all the time, there was a process developed in Akron, the Goodyear Tire Company, called vulcanizing, and those who were sort of looking to the future went up and took that course on how to vulcanize, and then in their various localities would start a vulcanizing shop. And that's what my father and his brother did. They started a vulcanizing shop in Toledo, Ohio, and were very successful. But when the Depression came and everything collapsed in 1929 and 1930, they lost their shop, and so my dad was pretty much out of work for almost 10 years. He just did odd jobs and did what he could We were on what was called, in those days, was called relief. It would be welfare today. We were on relief, and I remember we used to depend on some relatives who would bring bags of groceries for us. Or I remember going with my dad down to these agencies in Toledo that would hand out old dented canned goods and powdered eggs and powdered milk and all this kind of stuff. So it was up until, really until the war began, and in 1940 maybe, I think, is when he got employed at the Willis Overland plant, and then began to kind of stabilize economically, and our life changed a little bit, and he was able to buy a house, and our life became very different than it had been. But for the first 10 years of my life, my father was really, the family was struggling.
What's another, like, defining moment of your early life?
Well, I think a defining moment of my early life would probably be in grade school when, and then also in high school, when I realized that there might be another life for me other than the life that was there. In other words, my father always expected me to follow him at the Willis Overland plant and to work at the plant also, which in fact, when I went to college at one point, I did for a short time. But he was always expecting me to probably end up working in a factory like he did. This is what appeared to be the life that was available. But somewhere I realized that that I would be able to make something different with my life and that I could perhaps do it as an actor. And I knew this pretty early. Somewhere in grade school, I began to sense the possibility of this. You know, my voice changed early. And I remember that the teachers, when they would do little class plays and programs and things, they would select me sometimes for key roles because I, probably between the ages of 12 and 14, I didn't sound like a child. I sounded basically like an adult because my voice became so deep and so husky, so young. So, and I began to realize at that point that I sort of intuitively possessed some skills in this area. And I determined at a pretty young age to try and make the most of them. So here we are.
You know, we've talked about how authoritative and even threatening your voice is capable of being. Were there certain authority figures in your life, people who you heard expressing authority through their voice, who you've borrowed from as an actor?
You know, actually not. There weren't, really. You know, my father was obviously the main authority figure as a child growing up, and he was pretty quiet and self-contained. He didn't say too much. My mom was, you know, she was like all moms trying to, because I was the oldest of three boys, so she had her hands full just trying to control the three boys, but there was nothing particularly authoritative in her vocal manner.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't know exactly where that comes from. I think it, I do have some idea where it came from. Because my voice changed so early, and I was, whenever these, I told you, these class plays and things,
mm-hmm.
I was always the one cast as the principal, or the chief, or the mean father, uh-huh. or the, you know, so I started out as a kid acting these parts, because that's what the teachers gave me, because if you wanted an authentic adult-sounding voice in the play, it almost had to be me. So I think that's where it began.
So do you think you can use that quality in your voice when you need to be authoritative in real life, or when you need to be in a position of power?
That's a good question. And my my 7.5-year-old daughter and my 2.5-year-old daughter do not respond to this quality in my voice, I can tell you that. So in real life, it means absolutely nothing. I can scare people in movies on cue and on command, but my daughters are not in the least frightened by my big voice.
Well, I've really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, I've enjoyed this so much. I know I've rambled on here. But it's fun to be given an opportunity to ramble on.
Philip Baker Hall is now co-starring in the film Die Mommy Die. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
What you thought when you first began it, you got what you want. Now you can hardly stand it though, but now